Good morning. We'll get started with Sunday school. We're looking at competing worldviews and contrasting their claims with the world as we live it, as we experience it. And today we'll look some more at Darwinism, but let's open with a word of prayer. Father, this is the day that you've made for us, for our good, for your glory. We're going to rejoice, be glad in it, confident, Lord, in your goodness, the truth of your revelation of yourself as our creator and our redeemer, the one who sustains us through life. And we thank you for that, Father. Also the one who gave us this great world to live in, to enjoy, to study, to know you better. The heavens do declare your glory, Father. So as we study, pray for wisdom, pray for the filling of the Holy Spirit, illumination, pray that the words of my mouth would be pleasing to you today, Father. Pray it in Jesus' name, amen. Here are our two worldviews, and as we've discussed several times in the past, the humanist worldview, which begins with matter as the ultimate reality, as a consequence of the scientific revolution, had great success in explaining the world. Think back to Kepler and Boyle, and Galileo and Newton, the Christian founders of the scientific revolution. They were able to explain how the world operates very, very well with they call it positivism, a positive explanation of how the world works. But there was a missing piece of the puzzle. And that piece was biology. Richard Dawkins, writing in The Blind Watchmaker, 1986, noted this: biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. So whereas Kepler and Galileo and Newton could describe, say, the solar system and how it operated, there was no way they could explain the appearance of complicated things that were biological, us, you and me, okay? So what Darwin did, he provided that missing piece of the puzzle that completed a purely naturalistic account of how men and all the other variety of living things came into existence. And he did that without invoking God. It allowed him, as he said, and we've quoted him many times, it allowed him as an atheist to be intellectually fulfilled. He could now explain not only how the solar system works, but how people work as well. I was doing a little more study on this week, and came across this comment on the importance of the Darwinian Revolution. Historian Neil Gillespie says, Darwin's central innovation was a positivist definition of science that restricted it to natural causes. So we're talking about naturalism here, a closed universe with only natural causes, nothing supernatural. Once such a definition had been accepted, it simply nullified special creation as a scientific idea. Put the other way around, it was the prior success of positivism in science, Newton's ability to describe the orbit of the Earth around the sun, for example, the success of positivism in science that assured the victory of evolution in biology. There was no need to attack religion directly. but only to adopt positivism as the big word, epistemological. In other words, how do we know anything? As the epistemological standard in science. And this eventually took God out of nature as effectively as atheism. You know, let's see here. Richard Goldsmith, who was a geneticist at the University of California, writing in The American Scientist, 1952, stated the following: evolution of the animal and plant world is considered by all that are entitled to judgment to be a fact for which no further proof is needed. This evolution is now a fact for which no further proof is needed. It debunks the objectivity of any religious claims to truth. Any biblical claims to truth are no longer objective, they're subjective. So truth is divided, okay? We have science, objective fact, according to Goldsmith, that's evolution. And then we have faith kicked up into an upper story of knowledge that has no connection to science. And look, modern societies have become sharply divided over this. In the public sphere, the things that it's okay to talk about and teach, we have scientific knowledge. Part of that is the fact of evolution. But in an upper sphere, separate from that, we have the private sphere. Personal preferences, individual choices, religion, the Bible. See that? We have this divided truth. Okay. Well, what if Darwinism is not true? That's what we've been examining in the last couple of lessons. And Darwin himself proposed the falsification test. A falsification test is simply a statement that if this is true, then my theory is false. Okay? And his falsification test, taken directly from his Origin of Species, we'll read from it briefly a little bit later, but this comes right from the original source. And he said this: look, if, here's the condition, if numerous species belonging to the same genera or families, those are classifications of biological organisms, if numerous species have really started into life all at once, the fact would be fatal to the theory of descent with slow modification through natural selection. So if this is true, if things appeared all at once, then his theory is false. And again, in Origin of Species, reviewing the fossil record as it existed at the time, 1859, he noted this: we have seen in the last chapter of his book, The Origin of Species, that the species of a group sometimes falsely appear to have come in abruptly. And I have attempted to give an explanation of this fact, which, if true, would have been fatal to my views. So here again, he restates very clearly his falsification test. Richard Dawkins, writing in The Greatest Show on Earth, 2009, emphasized the point that evolution must be gradual, small steps, no big leaps. He said this: evolution not only is a gradual process, as a matter of fact, it has to be gradual if it is to do any explanatory work. If it's going to explain the existence of living things, it has to be gradual. Darwin in 1859, Richard Dawkins in 2009. What does the evidence say? We went over this in considerable detail last week, but I wanted to just emphasize the point. You propose the falsification test, then you go out and you look for the evidence. And here's Stephen Jay Gould summarizing a life's work of a paleontologist. He studied fossils. And he says, the history of most fossil species includes two features inconsistent with gradualism. Remember what the falsification test was. It has to be gradual. But the fossil record says it's not gradual. Here are the two features. Stasis: most species exhibit no directional change during their tenure. They appear in the fossil record looking much the same as when they disappear. Morphologic change, that's change in the way the body's shaped and the functions, the arms, the legs, so forth, is usually limited and directionless. But here's the key: sudden appearance in the fossil record. In any local area, a species does not arise gradually by the steady transformation of its ancestors. It appears all at once and fully formed. This is the characteristic of the fossil record. And we showed some fossils last week, and I got to thinking this week that, you know, I pulled these off the internet, and you know how easy it is to fake things on the internet. Are fossils real or are they fake? Well, this one claims to be a fossil trilobite. And then I showed this one last week because it's just such a beautiful picture of a trilobite, large in great detail. And it was so beautiful that I thought maybe it may be fake. I don't know. So I picked one up off the Smithsonian Institute website. I'm pretty confident it's not fake. And you can see the size there. It's a nice, large trilobite. And here's one that I know is not fake. Here's a fact, right? This is my own personal fossil of a trilobite. Facts are stubborn things. They must be dealt with in your worldview. And this is a fossil of a trilobite. Appears in the record fully formed and suddenly. How do we know? Well, let's look at the fossil record first. We looked at this again last week, the rock record. And this is simply a cross-section of the sedimentary rock that has been laid down over time and the fossils that are found in those rocks. And remember the Cambrian. Look what happens. Nothing, 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 and then suddenly, oh, there's a trilobite right there. It appears fully formed with no predecessors. Here's Stephen Jay Gould again. Increasing diversity and multiple transitions between fossil species seem to reflect a determined and inexorable progression toward higher things. But the paleontological record, here it is right there, that's the paleontological record, supports no such interpretation. There has been no steady progress in the higher development of organic design. We have had instead vast stretches of little or no change and one evolutionary burst that created the whole system. Here's the evolutionary burst right here. In fact, it was such a burst that paleontologists call this the Cambrian explosion, when all of these fully formed living things burst into existence with no prior record of their existence, okay? And it's not just trilobites. Up here in the Cretaceous, you see the little leaf there? There was another explosion of plants, flowering plants, that occurred later. Most things, most broad categories of living things come into the fossil record suddenly with no precursors, okay, and then they exhibit no change during their time in the fossil record. That is the characteristic of the fossil record. George Gaylord Simpson, he was a professor of zoology at Columbia and Harvard, one of the world's best known evolutionists during his life, lived from 1902 to 1984. Writing in the Majors of Features of Evolution, this was a textbook used at Columbia University to teach paleontology, okay? In spite of these examples, the examples he's referring to are evolutionary lineages of horses in the fossil record, okay? In spite of these examples, by the way, that horse evolutionary series has been questioned and essentially discounted since Simpson wrote this. But in spite of them, it remains true, as every paleontologist knows, that most new species, genera, and families, and that nearly all categories above the level of families, appear in the record suddenly and are not led up to by known, gradual, completely continuous transition sequences. Well, let's remember what Darwin's falsification test was. Let's go out and look at the fossil record. He says, if numerous species belonging to the same genera or families have really started into life all at once It's that fact, should be that fact, would be fatal to the theory of descent with slow modification through natural selection. So Darwin, in his Origin of Species, proposed the falsification test, and in the 170 years since, paleontologists have gone out and looked at the evidence and concluded that Darwinism is falsified by the fossil record. Okay? Well, Darwin actually proposed a second falsification test, and I want to look at that today. All of this so far has just been review. I'm going to read from the Origin of Species, if I can find the correct page here. Here we go. I'm on page 219 of my edition. I think this is the sixth edition. It's in a chapter he entitles Difficulties of the Theory. So he was an honest scientist. He said, look, there are going to be some problems with the theory. This is my guess as to how to explain the existence of complex living things without any recourse to God, no creator. And he writes this: if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. But I can find out no such case. Well, in Darwin's day, 1859, when he published the book, he didn't know much about the intricacies of life. Cells were just blobs of protoplasm. The ability to look into them in detail really didn't exist. So there was this notion that they knew what cells were, but they had no idea of the structure inside the cell. So he could find out no such case. Well, we now know much more about cells and biology than Darwin did. And there are many such cases. Okay? This is a bacteriophage. It's a T4 bacteriophage. What is it? It's a virus. And we're all kind of had a recent experience with viruses, right? Coronavirus. This is not a coronavirus. This is a bacteriophage. Let's look at, by the way, this is a electron microscope picture of this virus. You see the scale there, 100 nanometers? Right there, that's 100 nanometers. A nanometer is 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter. To give you some idea of the scope, a piece of paper, this is actually a thick piece, this is about 100,000 nanometers. So this guy's on the order of 100 nanometers, or 1,000 times smaller than the thickness of a piece of paper. We're talking really small things. That's why Darwin could find out no such case. He had no way to investigate living things at this level of detail. Well, what does a bacteriophage do? Oh, here's a picture of the bacteriophage. It's a representation showing its at the atomic level scale, showing its protein structure. Each one of these little guys here is a protein. And if you could think back several lessons, we showed how proteins are the basic building blocks of life. And they're built based upon a set of instructions that are contained in DNA. And so the essential feature of life is not matter, it's information, the instructions on how to build it, right? But you don't just need instructions to make living things. You need the machines to take those instructions and put them into effect and build the new living things. Viruses don't have any of that machinery. So what does a bacteriophage do, this virus? This is a representation, a schematic of the actual bacteriophage. Just go back and take a look. That's a photograph of a bacteriophage. Here's what it looks like schematically. It's got several parts. It's got a head, and inside the head is its DNA, its instructions for building itself, okay? And that's got a collar and a sheath and a tube and a base plate and some spikes. And what does a bacteriophage do? This guy over here is a bacterium, singular. And a bacteriophage attaches itself to the bacterium, and then the sheath contracts and inserts the tube into the bacterium so that its DNA can go into the bacterial cell, which has the machines necessary to reproduce the virus. A virus can't reproduce itself. It has to use the machinery that other living things have. So what is a bacteriophage? Hey, a bacteriophage is a smart, fully automated, nanoscale, 10 to the minus ninth meters, hypodermic needle. It's a machine, okay? What's a machine? A machine is, this is just a definition from the Oxford English Dictionary, which is probably the premier authority on what words mean in the English language. And it's an apparatus using or applying mechanical power and having several parts, each with a definite function, and together performing a particular task. Okay? What? Yeah, the comment is that this is a magnificent machine. It certainly is. Okay? And look, cellular machines are ubiquitous. Fancy word for meaning they're everywhere. Darwin knew of none of them. We know of many, many cellular machines. Here's one. This is a photograph, again, an electron microscope photograph of bacteria. And you can see these little guys coming off the tail here. That's called a flagellum. That's what the bacteria to swim around, okay? And the bacterial flagellum is a molecular machine. Okay, here's a electron microscope photograph of an actual bacterial flagellum in a bacterial cell. They just took the picture. Look, there's the scale, 20 nanometers. Remember how thick a piece of paper is? Who can remember? 100,000 nanometers, right? So this is a picture of a flagellum, the motor part of it. Which is 20 nanometers. And then here's the schematic on how it works. Look at all the different parts, okay, in that motor. That's a machine that's used to drive bacteria around in their environment. That's another one. Here's another one yet. These are called kinesin. And here's your homework. Go home and Google kinesin, K-I-N-E-S-I-N, and look at some of the videos that are available on YouTube on what kinesin do. This is a little roadway that's built in the cell so that the kinesin, which is basically a microscopic haul truck, can haul and distribute materials throughout the cell. You have to look at the video to fully appreciate what's going on. Darwin had no understanding of this. We do. Well, let's talk about machines made of many parts. And I want to use as an example a mousetrap, which I've been corrected this morning. This is actually a rat trap. But out of force of habit, I'm going to call it a mousetrap. So this is a machine. Its task is to trap mice. Okay? And it's made up of several parts. Here they are. Here's a base plate. Okay? And here's the hammer. This is the business end. Okay? And it's got a spring. And it's got a catch. That's this part here where you put the cheese and then you cock it, right? And it's got this holding bar which allows it to be cocked and wait until the rat comes by. And then it's got some staples. So I count six parts. There's three staples, but that's really one part. Here's the key. In order for this to function, to do its task, to act as a machine, all of the parts must be present and correctly assembled in order to provide any function. If any part is missing, Pastor Tim came up to me before and he said, he's been trying to catch mice, but one of the staples came out. that missing that one little part renders the machine inoperable. It no longer has function. All of the parts must be there in the beginning at one time, properly assembled for any function at all to exist. This cannot be built and have function by a slow, gradual process. Okay? You can't just have a base for a while and it works a little bit better by adding a spring, and then it works a little bit better, and then you add a hammer, and there's no function, there's no working at all until all the pieces are present. This idea was initially called out and published by Michael Behe in a book in 1996 called Darwin's Black Box, and he entitled it Irreducible Complexity. There's an irreducible number of parts which must be present all at once and correctly assembled in order for there to be any function. What does this say about Darwinism, about gradual development of functional, complex machines? All the parts must be there at once. They can't arise. They can't arise over time, gradually. Well, here's the bacteriophage. Here's its parts. There's a hood. We've got this tail section. We've got the fibers. Look, the head is has no function without the tail and the fibers. What can it do? It can't accomplish anything. The tail has no function without the head. It cannot perform a task. Similarly, the fibers have no function without the tail and the head. All the parts must be there from the very beginning, or there is no function, okay? None of the multiple components works by itself. The key, irreducible complexity. There is no slow, gradual route to the evolutionary assembly of this machine. Look at Darwin's second falsification test. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, here's one. Here's one. Here's a complex organ. It's called a virus. It has a task, a function. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. But I can find out no such case. And he couldn't. He didn't have the tools. We can. We have the tools. We know about molecular and cellular machines. We'll see a lot more of them in a video next week. Let's look at one more. We looked at this briefly a couple of weeks ago. This was called ATP synthase. Okay? It's a molecular machine. This is a membrane separating an organelle called the mitochondria in a cell from the rest of the cell, okay? And you can see you got this little motor here which turns this rotor, and what it does is it takes ADP and turns it into ATP. That's why it's called ATP synthase. ATP is like the fuel cell that runs life, all life. Has ATP synthase, which recharges the fuel cell that energizes life. This had to be present from the very beginning of life, because all plants, all animals, all bacteria have ATP synthase. Look how complex it is. Here's the picture of it showing all of the various proteins made up of amino acids joined together by instructions from what? DNA, information, the foundation of life. How could this have come into being stepwise, a little piece at a time? Well, we just looked at the mousetrap. We know we have to have all the pieces in order for the machine to function. You take out one piece, it loses its function. So all the pieces had to be there. But it's worse yet for Darwin, because each one of the pieces, let's look at this piece right here, which is the beta module. It is complex in itself. It had to be built by another machine, okay? An even more foundational machine. The parts themselves are extremely complex. How complex? Well, here's another picture of ATP synthase showing the amino acids that make up the proteins for the ATP synthase. Okay, here's the membrane that the motor turns in, and then this thing spins. It spins at 7,800 RPM. Some sources say it spins over 20,000 RPM. Let's just be conservative. 7,800 RPM, that's about 130 times per second. Each time it goes around, it spits out one ATP. In other words, it fills one fuel cell to send off to do some work within the cell, okay? If it can't be built by a step-by-step Darwinian process, what are the other options for how it came into existence? Well, the only other one is chance and necessity. Necessity being the chemical bonding between atoms to make the molecules, okay? And the other one is chance. And I want to deal with chance a little bit, and you'll see why in a moment. So this beta subunit right here, okay, is made up of amino acids. There are 20 amino acids available to make proteins. And depending on the order in which they are strung together in polymers, many MERS, many amino acids put together, then that protein will fold into a particular shape so that it can perform a function. It can be a machine, right? So that's what we're dealing with here. But the beta subunit has 478 amino acids in it. It's amazing that science has been able to count the number of amino acids in a beta subunit of an ATP synthase. I mean, to me, that's just really remarkable. Because how big is it? Remember, what are we talking about here? What's this distance approximately? It's on the order of what? Nanometers, which are 1,000 times smaller than the thickness of this paper. Science is really a remarkable tool for us. If you do a little mathematics, and I don't want to really spend much time on this, but the number of possible combinations of 20 things in 478 locations in the protein is a number that's about 10 to the 634th power. In other words, the chances of getting the right combination by sheer luck, by things bumping into themselves in a little warm pond in the early Earth, is 1 in 10 to the 634th power. How big is that? Well, the number of atoms in the universe is estimated at 10 to the 82nd. So you can see that this number is much larger than that number. In other words, the chance of getting the beta subunit correct by simple random operations is vastly smaller than the chance of picking out a given atom in the entire universe, okay? So either the ATP synthase came into existence by a Darwinian process, which it couldn't. Remember, rat traps, irreducible complexity, or by chance, which means we were really, really lucky, or by a design, right? Remember our friend Fred Hoyle, an honest atheist. And he's talking here about the probability of a smaller enzyme, a smaller protein. An enzyme is simply a molecular machine that helps chemical processes take place in living things. And he calculated the probability of assembling this smaller enzyme by chance. And he came up with 1 part in 10 to the 20th. Remember what ours are, 1 part in 10 to the 634th, okay? And Fred said this, we could face this small probability because One must contemplate not just a single shot at obtaining the enzyme, you don't just get one try, but a very large number of trials, such as are supposed to have occurred in an organic soup early in the history of the earth. That was Darwin's thought on how life came into being, an organic soup with all the right molecules in it, bouncing against each other, and then by luck, the correct string of molecules forming a protein that could reproduce itself came into existence. But Hoyle says this, the trouble is that there are about 2,000 enzymes, 2,000 of these molecular machines we know about, and the chances of obtaining them all in a random trial is only one part in, what it turns out, 10 to the 40,000th, which he correctly says is an outrageously small probability that could not be faced even if the whole universe consisted of an organic soup. Now, Hoyle was great for hyperbole, but this is not hyperbole, this is simply true. Look at the reference. He and Chandra Wickramasinghe wrote a book, Evolution from Space, in 1981. Why? Why did they write that book? Because they realized there is no chance that life could have originated on Earth because of probabilities like these. One chance in 10 to the 40,000. So, but here it is. So what do we do? Well, it came from outer space. So he wrote the book, Evolution from Outer Space. So what we have is outrageously small probabilities. And look, here's Thaxton, Bradley, and Olson writing in their book, The Mystery of Life's Origin. Wrote it in 1984. They've come out with a new edition in 2022, updating it. The conclusions are the same. And here's the conclusion. It is apparent that chance should be abandoned as an acceptable model for coding the macromolecules. Here's a macromolecule right here. That's a molecule with a lot of pieces, right? Okay, so we are abandoning chance as an acceptable model for coding the macromolecules essential in living systems. And then get this, in fact it has been, except in introductory texts and popularizations. You still read in some introductory textbooks, like for high school, and in popular magazines and so on, that life arose by chance in a warm little pond. I mean, you probably see that on a nature program on BBC even today, okay? But it's been abandoned by the people who've studied it and really know, okay? And we're to be wise as serpents, and we should know that as well. Remember Darwin's falsification test. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ, we just saw one, a ATP synthase, existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Again, like the fossil record, molecular machines, cellular machines, seem to falsify Darwinism. Well, what should be the response of a Christian to all of this? And when I say all of this, let's go back to even some of the prior lessons where we looked at scientific discoveries in cosmology that show that the universe had a beginning and that it's finely tuned. And now we have the fact that life at its foundation is information, and information always comes from a mind. What should be our response as Christians? Well, first, humility. There's much we don't know. Do you remember the issue with Luther and Kepler? There was much Luther didn't know. Not his fault. They just didn't know yet. Kepler came along, made some observations, realized that the earth revolves around the sun. And Luther had to learn some things. There's much that we don't know, even today. So we need to approach this with humility. We can be taught. There's no shame in learning new things and recognizing that you were wrong and now we know better, okay? And we have much responsibility. You know, in Psalm 8, let's just turn there. Psalm 8. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth. who has set thy glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and sucklings hast thou ordained strength because of thine enemies, that thou mightest still the enemy and the avenger. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him, or the son of man that thou visitest him? For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor. Thou madest him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, and the beast of the field, the fowl of the air, and the fish of the sea, and whatsoever passeth through the paths of the seas. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth. We have a job to do. We have work to do. We've been assigned dominion over this creation that God has made. Our response should be humility and realizing that we have responsibility to learn more. And we should also have confidence. Because God, look at Psalm 104, I think it's verse 28. I was looking at that this morning. O Lord, how manifold are thy works. In wisdom thou hast made them all. The earth is full of thy riches. We can have great confidence that we can understand God's creation because he made it in wisdom, the application of knowledge. He knows everything, and he put that knowledge to practice, to use in creating the universe for his glory and for our good. And we're created in his image, right? Look right here. The Christian worldview says that I'm created in God's image. He knows, he has wisdom. He created everything with that wisdom. I have access to that, right? That should be my response. What's the response of the secular humanist to all of this? This is a problem. Here's Richard Dawkins. Writing in The Blind Watchmaker. Let's see, I don't think I have this. Maybe I do. Nope. Writing in The Blind Watchmaker, he said this, even if there were no actual evidence in favor of the Darwinian theory, get this, even if there were no actual evidence, we've just gone over some evidence, right, from the fossil record and from cellular machines, we should still be justified in preferring it over all rival theories. Even without any evidence. Why? Well, last week I stumbled a little bit and I couldn't find this analysis from Michael Ruse, but I found it. So I want to read it to you. Who is Michael Ruse? Why should we care what Michael Ruse has to say? Well, he's a philosopher of science, an aggressive evolutionist. In other words, he's a hostile witness to my point of view. He's fully committed to this secular humanist worldview, okay? He's not my ally, he's my adversary. Not my enemy, my adversary. He has a different worldview than I do. He wrote a book, Darwinism as Religion, in 2016. He's so highly regarded by his evolutionary supporters, the scientific community, that he was called on to testify in court against the Arkansas creation statute. Remember, you may recall or you may know that in 1982, the state of Arkansas passed a law that said creation science must be given equal time, equal treatment with evolution in the public schools. The ACLU and some others took the state to court, and the court determined that that was an unacceptable of religion and the state power in the public schools, and so they shot down the Balanced Treatment Act. But Ruse, Michael Ruse, was called to be the principal witness for the evolution side. So that's who Michael Ruse is. That's why we care what he has to say. And here's what he said, writing in a Canadian newspaper, the National Post, in an article called Saving Darwinism from the Darwinians. And you'll get the feel for what he's saving them from in just a moment. He wrote this, evolution is more than mere science. Evolution is more than mere science. Evolution came into being as a kind of secular ideology. An ideology is a foundational set of beliefs from which everything else flows. Look, it's a worldview. Here's one. That's my ideology. And here's his ideology. In other words, evolution came into being as a kind of secular ideology, an explicit substitute for Christianity. He goes on to say this, I must admit that in this one complaint, the complaint is that Christians say evolution is a religion. In this one complaint, the biblical literalists are absolutely right. Evolution is a religion. This was true of evolution in the beginning, and it is true of evolution still today. Okay, so how do the secular humanists, the atheists, the evolutionists, respond to the evidence from the fossil record, say, and from molecular machines? Well, it's a religion, and this does not shake their faith. They continue looking for ways to explain the existence of complex life without recourse to a mind, to a creator. So what we really have here, what we're dealing with, is the conflict of two worldviews, two religions. We don't have science versus religion. We have the science of one religion versus the science of another religion. And look, as Christians, we can be both humble and confident that we have access to truth. Because, like Psalm 19 says, the creation and the Word have the same author. And when properly interpreted, we'll get the same answers from both. Okay? So, believers, we should take heart and we should rejoice in that truth. Next week, we'll look at a video which helps lock in some of these really intriguing facts of cellular machines. I think you'll enjoy it.